I don't know. Probably most of you haven't had this experience, but it's sort of interesting to know you need to preach Sunday morning, and it's your turn, and so you have this intent of thinking about it throughout the week, and it comes and it goes, and then by Friday night, at least for me, I like, okay, what's wrong with me? I should have this settled by now, and by Saturday night, if I don't have it settled, I'm like, this is getting bad, and I had a number of things on my mind, but it just didn't seem right, timing or knowledge on my part at the moment. So I chose one that it's been running through my mind, so I'm not sure if this is cooked as well as it should be, so if you have to finish cooking it, please be patient with me, and maybe you can do a better job on it. If I ought to put a word up here, let me see if I can find a good marker. I'd like to think about a little bit. I think I got this spelled right. Does anybody know what it means when something permeates something?
Soaks into it.
Soaks into it, okay. I'm not disagreeing. Any more ways you want to say it? Synonyms or ways of describing it? I'm sorry? Penetrates?
Completely throughout.
There you go. I have not, I think Cletus for one, I'm not sure, probably some others here, have a lot more pig experience than I do. But I've always thought a pig smells permeating. Is that right, Cletus? Somehow storing your cornflakes in a pig pen, would that be a good idea? Even with the box and with plastic, I'm not sure if it would actually get to the cornflakes themselves, but I would feel like it had. It just gets in, how I have it here, something is that gets onto and into everything exposed to it. Would that be right? So I think I'm going to change this. I don't know. Merriam-Webster didn't like this rendition, but my spell check didn't mind it, so I'm not sure who's right. So we'll put a dash in, because if you put a dash in, you can add anything you want onto a word. So we'll call it a permeator. Something that does this action to other things. So I'm going to talk a bit about permeators. Oh, I don't need to add an S there yet. Of life. And I did not choose this at all because of anything happening necessarily current in, well, at least in the people's lives around me. It was more just a thing I've thought about. Some other things that would possibly permeate are onions or garlic. So some people like the taste of garlic, and they'll eat it. And other people, I don't know if they don't like the taste, but they sure don't like the permeating effect of garlic. I guess that's safe to say. You know what happens maybe this time of the year, roughly? When a milk cow gets into a patch of wild garlic, what happens to her milk? Y'all have ever had any experience with that? It tastes like what they ate. the flavor didn't get lost in the process. And so my text passage is somewhat of a negative on permeating. I'd like to look at both sides of it, hopefully. But it's in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16 through 19 has been something on my mind. Proverbs has different times it mentions seven things. Sometimes it gives us those seven things, and the next time it just lets us sort through it. But this time it gives us the seven. I'll read that in a minute. Before we go there, don't read it if you don't know what it is. If you were to give me a list of big, bad sins that people do, what would be some of the top sins? If I was a really, really bad fellow, what would be some things I would have done or would be doing? I'm sorry?
Murder.
Okay, thanks.
Depending on the culture you live in, it would just be impatience.
Okay. Woo, Burton, you're getting hard on me. Okay, well, keep going. Good one. Adultery? Some more?
Lying.
I'm sorry?
Abuser.
Any more you want to put up there?
Idolatry.
Got wrong there, didn't I? Skip my A. Any more you want to put up? Okay, well, you are a well-balanced group, I guess. Bless you for that. Yeah, those are all sins, and they're all sins with big results, aren't they? I'm not here to maximize or minimize sin. I think theologically we know that sin is sin. We hear that often, but how often have you heard somebody say, all sin is sin, and then immediately the next thing they do is they start categorizing it. You ever heard? I've heard that many times in our kind of churches, and I think it's sort of ironic or foolish. Because true, it's true, all sin is sin, so theologically we're correct. But have you ever noticed that the sins I don't struggle with are usually pretty bad? I mean, when was the last time you were tempted to get out your gun and shoot someone, you know, be a murderer? We rate murder up there really high. Impatience, you know, sorry, Burton, I don't live in the Middle East or wherever you came from. I know it's not good, but it's not quite as bad, right? Murder, adultery, that's a pretty good one. Lying, yeah, but, well, I'll talk about that in a minute. Idolatry, that's a good one. Abuser, that's horrible. So, I think we all categorize sin, don't we? Do you? I do, much to my shame. Like I said, y'all covered some good ones that I didn't expect. I expected probably the last, before I left there for a minute. But I look at the list that Proverbs gives us, and it's fascinating where he starts in my mind. Because I think it's all too easy for us to sometimes excuse ourselves, even on sins that possibly I haven't done. Okay, let's just take murder for instance. I'm very glad, I'm very thankful. For one thing, I couldn't be with you this morning if I had likely. If I'd murdered somebody, you know, that'd be horrible. To live with the knowledge for the rest of your life that you took a life. For what? Yet at the same time, am I guilty of taking someone's life? That's actually one that's mentioned here. I'll talk about that a bit more. Let's see, what were some others up there? Adultery. You know, stealing another man's wife, that'd be a horrible thing to do as well. I'm so thankful I don't have to live with that. At the same time, there's gradients or nuances. What about spiritual adultery? Am I comfortable with that? Mixing things that belong to God with things that belong to this world. I think that's one we often skip over. Idolatry, a very good one. None of us has ever been tempted to go to the Buddhist temple, have we? In fact, I barely know where one is. I think I know now where one in the U.S. is. I'm sure there's more. But in Gainesville, Florida, a number of weeks ago, I was there with my in-laws, and we came down through this one street, and there was some for going on. I didn't know what. And I think my in-laws thought I was getting them into a bad situation or something. We survived. In fact, one of the last things we saw was a fellow with a great big boa constrictor around his neck. I still don't know what the whole deal was. A couple weeks later, I was back there with someone else, and they were looking on their phone, and they mentioned that maybe there's a Buddhist temple, and they thought maybe it had something to do with that. I don't know. It did seem like the street in front of it was blocked off. But, you know, none of us has gone to that temple, kneeled down to an idol, and, right, we wouldn't even be tempted. I mean, foolishness. Yet, do I have a problem with idolatry? I think you should be able to think that one through yourself. Abuser, horrible thing. But yet, are there some ways that possibly I'm comfortable in abusing others? Okay, let's read this. Proverbs 6, verse 16. And I'm going to try to make this intensely practical for myself, and I'm sorry if I damage you in the process, but hopefully you'll survive, and like I said, cook it better. Proverbs 6, verse 16. I call this the seven abominations, another set of sevens from Proverbs. These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him. A proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, an heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. You know, friends, this morning, if you, God forbid, have a problem with any one of these seven, I would like to suggest to you that it will permeate your life. And the sad thing is, in looking at my own heart, I am actually somewhat I'm sorry, but I'm somewhat comfortable with at least a couple of these, more than I should be. And when it permeates my life, it will affect all I do, all I say, and how I live. And again, I'm not trying to say some sins are necessarily greater than other sins, but I had to wonder as I looked at this list, do you think some of the bigger sins, possibly, that we classify, at least in my head that way, do you think they spring from not dealing with some of the ones I'm comfortable with in this list? What do you think? So the first five he gives us are, this, you have to understand, Proverbs was written in a poetical way. It'd be fun to read Hebrew and read it to you, see if you could hear the flow better. And even where the words didn't rhyme, it was a flowing of thought. So some of this, so he gives us five body parts, if you will. So he has a proud look, the eyes, a lying tongue, the hands that shed innocent blood, the heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift and running to mischief. So those five, he's mentioning a body part that's involved. And you know, it's often fascinating to me in myself and also in others how when I'm struggling in my life, I would like to think that my struggle is somewhat hidden, right? But so often we give ourselves away by our feet that run to mischief, by our hands that do things they shouldn't, by our eyes that have a haughty look. So let's just look at these and break them down into at least everyday life for myself. Number one, a proud look. One thing I should maybe say about this is an abomination. That's a pretty strong word. How many of you used that in the last week? You said something's an abomination to you. Pretty serious. An abomination is something you can't stand. I guess let's go back to the garlic thing. If garlic is an abomination to you, you'll be like one of my friends. He pretty much forbade his wife to eat any garlic because it's an abomination to him. I don't know if that's a right use of his authority or not, but he can't stand the garlic, so no garlic, okay? So that's when something's an abomination to you, you can't abide it. You can't tolerate it. There's just no place. Yeah, just my life is too short to have this in it. And in thinking of how this is to God, in our walk with God, these things are an abomination to him. Basically, I don't want to say that God doesn't love us if we struggle with any of these. At the same time, I can't really walk with God if these things define who I am. So number one, going back to a proud look. I'm going to define that as a haughty attitude. You know what that is? A looking around to see how I compare to others. A hoping others notice me. This one is probably one. I guess if there's one in this list that every living person struggles with in some way or other, it's probably this one. Would you agree? I have to think of a young lady, not from here, that she was very, she was very focused when she went places, which was good. Proverbs actually tells you to have, you know, keep your eyes straight and all that. So that was good. But one of the ladies she worked for at that time in her life told her that, "You're proud. I mean, I was drove right by and I waved and you never even saw me." And I said, "You're proud." And she's like, "Oh, no, I'm not proud. I just mind my own business." Well, I don't know. I'm not here to judge her. I do know her very well. In fact, it was my mom, to be honest with you. And I think later in life, she would have realized that maybe she was proud. And so there's a thing of where I've noticed this trait. I think maybe it's a little bit of a family trait for some of us. I think I told you some years ago in a message, but I had one of my cousins talk about the way one of my brothers and I used to walk. And you know, when you have this look, you have this walk, you show something about yourself. They look down my nose at everyone, so to speak. You know, Psalms 101:5, the last part of the verse says this: "Him that hath an high look and a proud heart, I will not suffer." Him or her that hath an high look and a proud heart, I will not suffer. God just doesn't have time for a proud person. I like Psalm 131, verse 1, puts it in a positive way. He says, "Lord, my heart is not haughty, nor mine eyes lofty, Neither do I exercise myself in great matters or in things too high for me. A wise person there. Wish I would have never tried to do things that were too high for me. That would be great. I guess I can start today, right? But I just like that thought. Lord, my eye is not haughty, nor mine eyes lofty. Neither do I exercise myself in great matters or in things too high for me. You know, it's just much better sometimes, rather than trying to explain what you really don't understand, what you don't comprehend, sometimes humility dictates that I just say, I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe I need to study on it. Maybe I need to learn. But there's nothing wrong with admitting I don't know it. I had to recently, again, listening to one of those vet stories that some of you know of, and had to think about, they were at this one farmer's place that he could never be surprised. And they got this one tumor just came off the cow, and the poor farmer was there. He couldn't ask what had happened to it because he had this problem. But he was desperate to know where this thing had got to, and it just drove him crazy almost. And when they left, he was tore back into his cow shed and was there with his glasses on, peering around on the floor for something that wasn't there. And you know, that's what pride does to you. It makes a real idiot out of you. But you don't feel it when you're in it, do you? I guess the other, again, on the positive side, Psalm 51 verse 17 says it this way: the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. There's just no room for pride in a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. You know, in my life, I think I've noticed two heart problems that lead to a proud look, if I may say it that way. Two heart problems that lead to a proud look. Those who feel superior and those who feel inferior. And it's sort of paradoxical, isn't it, that opposing problems have the same fruit, but they often do. I've seen it myself, and I think I've seen it a couple times outside of myself. If I feel superior, it's not too hard to track pride in there because I'm better than, right? My ideas, my way of doing things, my thought process, whatever it is better than yours because I'm superior. Easy to track that one. But I've often noticed that when I feel inferior, when I'm running myself down mentally, I feel like I'm worthless, nobody cares, nobody understands, nobody loves me, you know, that whole package of things. It's amazing how often, if I let that fester in my life, it comes out as pride as well. You ever notice that? Where I have to sort of try to lift myself up. I try to be somebody because I feel like I'm nobody. And it's just another form of pride, friends. I'm not here, if you have that problem, to beat you down with this necessarily. But, you know, let's say it this way. If God created me, which I believe he did, and he created you and all other people, what is there to feel superior about? Nothing. I didn't make myself, neither did you, so neither one of us has anything to feel superior about. Good. If God created me and all other people, what is there to feel inferior about? Again, there's nothing, right? You see how foolish it is, but yet how hard it is for me to get there. You know, if the work of God, the shed blood of Christ, is needed to cleanse and save me just as much as any other sinner, what is there for me to be lifted up about? Yet it's also true, again, that if it takes the work of God and the shed blood of Christ to cleanse and save me just as much as any other sinner, I am just as precious to Christ as anyone else. So what's there to feel inferior about? Recently, and hope the person that I had this discussion with can forgive me. I didn't bring this in because of it, but I had to think of it. Dignity. I was thinking of dignity. How many of you dignified? We probably recognize the times we felt undignified. Made a fool out of ourselves. I had to think of one lady, Lloyd Esther's sister, trying to get something off the pulpit, you know, and she come up behind the door, tried to dive for the pulpit and back out and fell out and sprawled out across the platform in front of the whole church a couple minutes before it starts. You know, you remember something like that because it hurts your dignity badly. So I want to be careful here. I'm not promoting that all of us just come out here and purposefully stumble on the platform before church to try to wound our dignity to see how we feel about ourselves. That's not what I'm saying. That would be foolishness. But I would like to encourage us in this thing of not having pride. I think sometimes pride enters into not being real, can I say? Let's just be real. There's times that in realness I have to grow, okay? I might have some childish ways of playing jokes and things that I need to grow up in. And I want to be willing to at least try to do that. But in who you are, in a Christ-like way, be real. So many people, I think, are scared to be open and to honestly share their life and struggles because so many of the rest of us aren't real. We project something that we aren't. We really aren't. You know, if someone has a problem, let's say someone in our church, just for argument's sake here, not trying to say this is the case, but has a problem being open, honestly sharing their struggle and their problem, let's make sure it's their problem, not our projection of our perfection. Because it's so easy to start projecting that we're something when we're nothing. You know, it makes me think of a dear brother. I love this brother dearly. And he's a leader in a church. And yet I'm going to tell you what one of the people in his church said about him. He said this. He says, I wonder if he even ever struggles with the things I do. And I know this brother, and I know this brother's heart well enough that I happen to know he does. But I also happen to know that for whatever reason, when he preaches or gives testimony, he maybe finds it difficult to be as open as he should. I'm not trying to judge him. But you know, that's sad because I feel he's actually less effective with some of the people in his church because I think it's unintended, honestly, but in his unintended way of projecting maturity and things, it almost does the reverse of making him useful in what God has for him. So I'm not saying there's maybe wise ways to share and unwise and all that, and I don't have time to dissect that all for you. But let's be real. Well, if it's in a message, I guess I overdo it. I know some places probably wouldn't appreciate, but I'm needing this message, okay? So that's why I'm sharing it with you. Whether it's in testimony, it's great. If God has given you victory in an area of your life, by all means, share it. Be open about it. Let's rejoice together that you're experiencing victory. At the same time, don't just always share victories and never defeats, because guess what? If you're human, you've got some defeats there somewhere. Don't hide them, necessarily. Especially if you're with a group that you're accountable to, there's a right way to sometimes share that, especially if it's ongoing. Another thing I've noticed is, and I'm trying to hit myself as much as anyone here. I don't know how the ladies' prayer groups are going exactly. I guess that's their problem, not mine. But thinking about our accountability groups that some of us as church brothers have, you know, I've noticed, again, I'm going to share from my heart, so if I've cooked it wrong, that's okay. You go fix it for me. But it seems to me like so often we end up with groups that have one or two people that do all the sharing of defeat, and the rest sort of sit there piously, and then it becomes sort of an old thing. And that bothers me, because I know it's discouraging to the ones that are struggling. And maybe there are times in life where some of us do have more intense battles with certain areas than what others do. But if you sit in one of those accountability meetings, and I'm the brother that's struggling intensely at the time, and month after month of meetings, I am the one that has to open up and share my failure, my struggle, and the others sit there and, well, we'll pray for you, brother. Yeah. And then it's their turn to share. Well, and they almost say, well, if I have something to share, I would, but it's really don't have anything. And I'm like, serious, wish you could have some of mine. Something just don't quite ring true to me. I'm so glad for Victorious Living, don't get me wrong. But I would suggest, in the little bit of life I've experienced, that there's something happening. Okay, so the battle may be different. I accept that. It may be in a completely different area. But let me just say this. If I'm an accountability meeting, and let's say one of the brothers is having an intense battle in one area, Guess what? One area I can always confess that I'm still struggling in is the one Vernon brought up about impatience. None of us is getting home scot-free, brothers. And if you don't have a battle that you need your brothers to pray for, you're missing it. That's what. It's not that it's not there. If you don't have any struggles, what's happening? I think there's one of two things happening. You're either deceived and not seeing something, the area that maybe God wants you to grow in, or you're denying, you're not owning your problem. Maybe that's too blunt. Maybe some of you know how to live victoriously year in and year out without struggles with impatience and things, but I question it. I really question it. So there you have my bit. Okay, let's move on to a lying tongue. Most of these are shorter in case you're getting worried. A lying tongue. Some of you look tired. Why don't we just all stand up? I thought the picnic was last week, so maybe you're still recovering. Okay, a lying tongue. You know, the Bible's got a lot to say about a lying tongue. Just look it up. Dishonesty. And I would like to think that dishonesty is never once named, like to quote Paul, in a Mennonite church or in a Christian church. Because if dishonesty is a horrible problem to have, probably the best illustration I could think of is quicksand. Do you all know what quicksand is? I guess most of you have not been in it, or we had a lot of people rescued, because you know quicksand is something that you get in it, and there's no bottom. It's just this shifting thing, and the more you struggle, the deeper you get, and the deeper you get, the worse you struggle, and it just, there's no bottom to it. And you know, if you're working, trying to help someone who has a dishonesty problem, it's a lot like quicksand, because pretty soon you have no idea what's true and what's not true when they talk to you. And it's, I hate it, because I'd love to trust people. I want to give them a chance. I want them to, but if they just lie, blatantly lie to you, finally there's no bottom. And you know, the really sad thing is, not only is there not a bottom for me in trying to figure out what's true, there's also no bottom for the person doing it. Because so many times, say, so you said this and this wasn't true. What about this? Is that true? Oh, yes, yes, I would never lie about that. I'm sorry. That very phrase that I would never lie about that sends off warning bells that you either have or are about to. You just can't go there. Okay, you can be seated. See if you can stay awake, please. You know, Proverbs 12, just to read some other verses that talk about this problem, this sin. Proverbs 12, verse 19 through 22, he gives us the pros and the cons, I guess, if you will. It says, the lip of truth shall be established forever. Was that Thomas Strock, like Mim's dad, when he was here preaching? He said something about if you speak the truth, you don't have to remember what you said because you always say the same thing. Something to that effect, I think. And I love that. That's so true. You know, if I'm speaking the truth, if I tell you if I catch a 19-inch fish and I tell Tony this week and I tell Brian next week, it's still 19 inches, right? 19 inches is always 19 inches. It don't matter. And that's such a relief because otherwise you really get yourself in a pain. The lip of truth shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. And I think that's exactly what he's saying is what Brother Thomas said there. You know, when you speak truth, it's the same. I can tell you the same story. If I'm alive, well, what shall I say, 40 years from now, and I tell you the story, and I told it truthfully yesterday, it'll be the same story, right? It's not going to somehow evolve or change. But he says, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. If I fibbed to you yesterday, in 40 years, my poor brain won't even remember what I said. So if yours does, then I'm in trouble, right? Deceit is in the heart of them that imagine evil. If I'm letting my mind run, I will not speak the truth, I guess is that's what that's saying. But to the counselors of peace, those encouraging peace, it is joy. Or is joy. There is no evil. There shall no evil happen to the just, but the wicked shall be filled with mischief. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are his delight. I also want to read Malachi 2, verse 6 says, talking of a priest that God wants, it says, the law of truth was in his mouth. The law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity and did not turn and did turn many away from iniquity. Wow. Just think about it. Speaking the truth gives me an opportunity to help turn others away from iniquity. Because guess what? If I fib to the fellows I work with during the week, tell them an untruth, I understand there's sometimes failings and failures in communication that need correction. I'm not talking about. I'm just talking really stretching things or sort of have a reputation that way. Do you think that when I sit in Sunday school and talk, they won't be a little skeptical about what I say? Rightly so. And that's just the beginning. How much my customers, if I quote one price, and this has been a real challenge, honestly, with our prices have almost doubled in the last, I guess it's over a year now. And so I've tried my best. But let's say that I quote someone a price in good faith and they know it and I'm on the road and I'm busy and then they come back a week later and want to order the door and it's a different price. If I didn't put some disclaimer on that, do you think they'll be open to having a discussion about Christ? Probably not. We better be serious about it, and I want to be. It's been hard. Not that I feel I've done a lot of that, but sometimes I think it's just better if there's a disagreement to say, okay, I'm sorry. I'll take your price even if I can't afford to, and we'll go from there, because I'd rather have them know me as honest than be profitable. Okay, let's move it on. Enough on that one. Oh, here's another one, actually, that I run into business. I was just going to use an illustration. One I've really struggled with. Maybe y'all can help me. So I get, I don't know how many phone calls in a day. Sheila's been a wonderful blessing sorting through those things. But I still get a lot of calls in a day. And it is so easy to tell someone, I'll check that and call you back. And maybe I never think about it again. Worst case scenario. Or I think about it in 3 days. And I'm like, I get so tired of apologizing. But what do you do? So I'm trying to wean myself from saying I'll call you back. I'm trying to tell them, I'll try to call you back. If I don't, call me back. And that way it's sort of back on them if they don't hear from me, because I just hate the feeling of a call that I just clean forgotten. You know, I was preparing, actually I was in church already this morning, and a brother from a different church had called with some struggles that in his home, and he wanted me to check out something for him, and I think I told him I'd call him back last week, and I didn't. I feel stupid, but I'll make sure I do. But you know, how honest am I honest? And I think that brother will definitely forgive me. Some people are more so than others. But how should I do that? Because it's so easy to say, I'll call you back. And I have every intent. And I would say 90% of the time I do. But what about the 10%? What does that let in their mouth? Definitely something I want to keep growing on. Okay, three. Third one is hands that shed innocent blood. Maybe you think I should just skip this one. Like I said, if there'd be a murderer here, unless you somehow managed to hide it, which that's a hard thing to hide, you probably wouldn't be here, right? So I'm not talking to murderers this morning. I mean, I'm 99.9% sure there's no murderer here this morning. I mean, I probably could vouch for any of you if somebody came in and you were accused of it. I'd say, oh, no, they didn't do it. I'm sure they didn't. Okay? So what about this? Who, sitting in a Christian church this morning, is guilty of having hands that shed innocent blood? I would like for you, if you need something to do in your personal devotions or some other time, to study into this phrase. The studying I have done indicates that this is often connected, not so much, yes, it would include murdering somebody in cold blood to steal from them or take advantage of them. It would include that, but it actually means, has the broader sense of meaning, those who gain through the loss of others. Those who gain through the loss of others. I want to say this carefully, but I think, I'm quite sure I believe as a Christian, when I gain, others should gain as well. And let me make this practical for you. May I talk about you, Jonas, a little bit? So Jonas has a shop and fixing cars. And you know, it's great for me to take my truck, my car out there and have Jonas fix it. And if Jonas, as Jonas fixes that car, I expect a bill. He's due some gain because I also gain by having my car work, right? Now, if Jonas would make no effort to repair my car, He would know that, let's say, two wires are parted, and rather than making sure it has a good wiring harness, he just twists them together so that I can get off the lot, and he still charges me for a new wiring harness, and I drive down the road, and 50 miles later, this thing quits for the same problem. And I'm talking about intentional. I imagine Jonas is like me. Some days we have unintentional problems. And he's like, yeah, it's funny, Joe. We'll be back pretty soon. I get to charge them all over again. You know, that would be gaining at my loss. It's okay to gain when my customer gains. But if my customer is not gaining along with me, I don't think that's a business for a Christian. Let me read a couple verses and you consider them. Jeremiah 22, verse 3. Thus saith the Lord, execute ye judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor. And do no wrong, do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow, neither shed innocent blood in this place. Notice how it's all hooked together. Thus saith the Lord, execute ye judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor. It's actually our job as God's people to, when we see somebody being taken advantage of, to at least give them, if we have the opportunity, to save them from that catastrophe, to offer them that route. To deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor. Do no wrong, do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow. I like this in 1 John chapter 3, verse 11, and then verse 16 and 17. He says this, and this is, of course, talking of in the church now. For this is the message that ye have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us. We ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoso hath this world's goods, I have what I need and some to spare, and seeth his brother or his sister have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? Brothers and sisters, I don't know. I've got these crazy arguments with some people. Come to think of it, I try to pay them or at least be nice to them, and they about won't let me. You know, one thing I don't want to happen to me is to come before God and say that I owed somebody somewhere something. It's just not worth it. So please let me share with you. I mean, if I've got plenty, why not? And of course, I know, and like I've been preached a message to recently about being willing to receive, I gotta let you the same privilege, don't I? So there's two sides to every coin. But I'm still saying that. You know, it's probably going to be quite a while before any of you come wandering around my place without needing some clothes, okay? Or come to my door and say, I'm hungry, could you feed me? So how am I supposed to do this verse unless I do it on things less than that? You know, it's interesting. If I read this verse, it almost sounds like what the world calls socialism, right? Take from the ones that have to give to the ones that don't have. And yet, it's got a fascinating twist that's much better than socialism, in that it is to be a voluntary helping, coming from a heart of love. Love for God and love for others. So very different than socialism. You know, and I'm not trying to get political in any way. I let that with that system, that kingdom. But what is sort of fascinating to me sometimes in reading how some of these things go is there's some people in this nation that would encourage the government to take more, to give so that they can give more. And if that's what they want to do, Caesar can do what he wants to do. But you know what's funny? Is that was never the intent of true helping. It wasn't government. It was to be through the church. People giving to needs. And you know, if all of us as churches stepped up and took care of the needs in our churches, and I think, not to pat ourselves on the back, I appreciate how you do. It's not that I'm complaining. And then we broadened out and tried to at least do the little bit we could in our community. Finally, there would be no need for a government that would do that, because it'd be taken care of. And how much better and what a greater blessing it is to share because I want to than to share, pay my taxes, right? Even though I should do that. Okay. Here's another thing. I got to be careful here. I'm not being critical of anybody's business and how you do it. Here's just something I wanted to mention. It came to my mind when I read these verses. Just the other week or two ago, I had a customer, or prospective, I should say, customer call. And he wanted a garage door, but what he wanted more, what was way more important than the door, was whether I financed the door. And we had had the discussion as a business with everyone there, I think, some time ago. Or at least the ones involved. whether we should do this or not. It's something we could be doing. And we decided not to. And I lost that sale because I didn't offer financing. I don't know whether I should have or not. I told him, sir, I said, I'd be glad to sell you a door. But I said, honestly, the financing program I could get for you is so expensive that you'd be better off putting it on your credit card. And I said, really, you would be much, much better off going to your bank if you're in desperate needs for a garage door and tell them, hey, I need a loan here. He didn't like that. He didn't care, I guess, what it cost. So again, I'm not trying to make rules for others, but I'd like to ask a question I think we should be considering. Are we, depending how financing and things are structured, is that something we as Christians can do? Are we gaining at the loss or the gain of others? You know, if my occupation and my way of life does not help and bless those I'm working for, it seems to me that I'm verging on violating the principle of not gaining by the loss of others. Okay, moving on to the fourth one. A heart that deviseth wicked imaginations. Now, surely, if there's one I could skip, it would be nobody in a Christian church this morning would have a heart that deviseth wicked imagination, whatever that is. I mean, I trust that quite a few of us have imaginations, and that's probably okay. Use them properly. But what's he talking? Wicked, a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations. In looking at this, I'm going to put it my own words, a heart dedicated to seeing how he or she can get his or her own way. Happy to use others and then cast them aside if it accomplishes what self wants. Let me give you an illustration of how this happened in the past. Genesis 6, there before the flood. Genesis 6, verse 5 and 6 says, "And God saw the wickedness of man, that it was great upon the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart." You know what's interesting is in the King James Version of the Bible, at least, I believe every time that imagination is used, it's used negatively that I could find. If I'm wrong, I'd be happy to know. So I'm not thinking that the ability to imagine things is not wrong. That's not what I'm saying. But when I use my ability to create, how can I say, a reality or something that shouldn't be, then there's a problem. Jeremiah 17, verse 9 and 10 says this, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" Then verse 10, God says this, "And I, the Lord, search the heart, I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings." So no matter, even on the best days, as the best Christian, my heart has still some tendency towards deceit. Is that right? Would you agree? Your heart's deceitful, even when you're a Christian. And so when you're not a Christian, can you imagine how much more deceitful your heart is? So as a Christian, I need to do my best to control my thoughts, my attitudes. As an un-Christian, I'm probably not even really trying, at least in some areas. And so you factor those wicked imaginations into a sinful heart, you create all sorts of nasty things. And I've done this enough, friends, to tell you that's a very discouraging way to live. I'd like to tell you that I'm completely over it, but I'm afraid I'm not. It's something that I have to keep working on. Still need God's help to make sure there's no wicked imagination. To continually harbor whatever it is, resentment, bitterness, envy, rejection, lust, whatever word you want to put in there, when we just harbor it, we stick it in our heart and we run it through our minds, that's a horrible way to live, a sad way to live, a depressing way to live, and it's not Christ's way to live. Okay, number 5. We now have the feet that be swift in running to mischief. Be interesting to know what you all think when you think of feet that run to mischief. I just get this picture of a small person that sees a fight or something going on, and they streak it over there to join the fray. Just full tilt right into it. Let me just be part of this mess. I would like to think that adults don't do it, and probably we're smart enough not to do it physically sometimes. But I would say this possibly. You know, as many people I don't know what the current population of the world is, probably between 6 and 7 billion. As many people as this world holds, I find it somewhat astonishing how some people are tangled up in many, many problems. You ever notice that? It's just, I start talking to someone maybe about, it can be, I think they have no clue about this person somewhere else. Then as you talk long enough, suddenly you discover that this person from far away had feet that ran to mischief, and they're tangled up in this thing too. It's beyond me how it works. I mean, I've known some people a good portion of my life that didn't have a clue about the other. And I'm talking people aren't living the way they should. And in the last 2 years, especially the two of them I'm thinking of, somehow they got connected. I'm like, how do feet run to mischief? They seriously do. It is just amazing. You know, I like the contrast in Isaiah 52, verse 7. It says, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. You know, on the flip side of that, what I said is amazing how many times certain people are mixed up in certain problems. While that's true, it also amazes me how some great Christians that are seeking to portray Christ to others pop up here and there as well, surprisingly often. And I thank God for that. I'm not trying to say that if God has given you a job in a way you can bless and help, don't stay out of things. But what I'm talking about is the people that smell church problems. They smell personal. They smell home problems. And they're just there. And it always gets worse when they're involved. And I'm like, what are you doing? That's exactly what it's talking about. Feet that are swift and running to mischief. So as a challenge to myself, what do you spend your time and energy on sharing? When you get together with your friends and you just have a good time, do you share about that person's problem, this person's issue, that church is going on? And I don't mean to say this critically. I love some of these people. I love some of these churches. But brethren and sisters, let's work hard to make sure that we aren't feet that run quick to mischief. Because I've seen so much negative of this in my life. And I guess I won't necessarily name these people and places, but I know a couple brothers that I dearly love. But when they get together, it just astonishes me how much negativity they have about this church, about that person, about this thing, and that going on. I'm like, even if you know it, why would you talk about it? Sometimes you can't avoid knowledge, but you sure don't have to sit there and hash it out. You know, me sitting in Arkansas telling you about some church problems in Pennsylvania, what are you going to do about it? It's foolish, and I'm not, again, directing this at anyone, but let's stop it. Let's not go there, and I'm blessed by you as a church that we don't have more of that, yet I have a burden that we would do even less in talking about people and places. You know, one thing that was a huge relief in moving to Arkansas, I've sometimes felt years ago, I've been here, what now? Oh, I forget. I think it's going on 16 years, so y'all put up with me a long time. But you know, one thing that had me so negative as a young man when I first came here was all the church and people problems that I had to hear about. And it was such a relief just to fall off the edge of the earth. Now, time and position has changed somewhat. I'm not saying I can evade or that I should run from all those knowledge. But you know, the last thing I should do is sit here and burden people that don't need knowledge. I mean, it's one thing if you can help it or if you can pray for it. But just to discuss it, come on. Let it lie. Okay. 6, a false witness that speaketh lies. I don't know why he repeats this. Almost seems like the honesty thing again to me. It's a little different twist. You now have someone that's supposed to be witnessing, saying what's true in a situation, and they're speaking lies. So it's even worse, I guess. I don't know. So it's one whose veracity is to be doubted. In other words, when they share, when they witness to you about a circumstance or incident, that's not necessarily true. Proverbs 14, verse 25 says, a true witness delivereth souls, but a deceitful witness speaketh lies. And I would say this, that a deceitful witness actually, with God's help, it doesn't have to be this way, but I think often a deceitful witness actually keeps people from coming to God. It poses a hindrance because they project, they give things that aren't true. So I had two questions for myself. What do I bear witness of? When you meet me, when we talk, when I bear witness to you of my life, am I talking about Joe, his problems, his failures, his things? Or do I talk to you about God and what God is or at least wants to do in me? And how do I bear witness of what it is? Am I depressed? Do I stretch things? Or do I share just clearly, honestly, what God wants to do? And you know, this can be such a tricky thing. In some ways, I think I'm probably still growing. I have tried, honestly, to grow in this. But I'll give you something that happened to me some years ago in some church work here. And it's nobody else's fault. This is all on me, okay? But in probably being somebody that still is, has been too quick to speak and too slow to hear sometimes, I was trying to grow and listen to people and hear their viewpoint. And so I tried really hard. I tried really hard to just sit down with a couple brothers that had opposing views on some things and to just hear them. And I would try to ask them questions and sort of express some thoughts. You know what happened? The two that didn't necessarily agree both left meeting with me feeling like I agreed with them. I guess that was a false witness, wasn't it? I felt terrible, and I've tried to straighten it up, and I've tried not to ever do it again. So if you're trying to talk to me and I sit there shaking my head, no, I guess you know why, because I don't want to be a false witness. No, I've got to be careful there. But it can be tricky, and I know I was guilty. The one came and confronted me with it, and I was like, I sure didn't mean it that way, but I see what you're saying. And I'm sorry. I still want people that think differently from me. I still want to hear their viewpoint. I still want to understand why they think that way. But I have to be very careful that in that process, I don't make them feel like I'm agreeing with them necessarily. And that's hard because I don't know. I like when people agree with me. Maybe you're not that way, so I always trying to, yeah, at least I understand that side of it, you know, try to encourage them to be open, and then here, whoops, here I got into the false witness camp. So I guess if you think I need some more help on there, fire away. I'll try to take it. Okay, moving on to the last one. 7, he that soweth discord among brethren. I thought maybe I should just assign Ernie or Jason a whole message on this one, because I thought this was such a wonderful phrase, sowing discord among brethren. Wow, that sounds bad. Sounds scary. Do I have a problem with this? Put it in my own words, I'm going to say, he that encourages disagreement or amplifies misunderstandings. He that encourages disagreements or amplifies misunderstandings. I think I've changed some. I used to love a good argument as good as anybody. And I still don't mind, you know. You want to argue about power tools or something? That is, I probably still join you a little bit there occasionally. But at the same time, let's be really, really careful, even on the small and harmless things, that we aren't sowing discord. I wanted to focus on that word sowing, or soweth in this case. You know, the old time planters, they didn't have these, you know, magic planters or whatever that drop seeds at the exact spot. You know, they prepare the field at least for wheat and some of that, and then they go out and sow in the truck. And a good sower, so to speak, as he threw, that was one of those things, I think, if you did enough of it, you could sort of gauge that most of your wheat would land, you know, within the field. That was a little difficult not to get some out across the edge. But as you sowed, as those things left your hand, you could say, oh, come back. I threw there wrong, yeah? It was sown. It's gone. And I guess I'm thinking that as we speak to each other as brothers and sisters, let's be very careful that as we sow our words and they leave us, we can never return them back to ourselves necessarily. That we have thought, that we have gauged, that we know where these seeds go. Because once you sow discord, it's too late. You know, I've sat in too many, let's say it that way. I won't say many, but too many church meetings. And not necessarily here again, but where evidently there was some sowing of discord. And you know, even if the people, if all those who had done it would have realized it and knelt down right there and repented, there still would have been things to work through because it was sown. soweth discord. He that encourages disagreements and amplifies misunderstandings. So how do I relate when I know that two brothers, two sisters, a marriage, whatever, when I know that there's some disagreement, some struggle going on there? Maybe I can't solve it, but dear brothers and sisters, at least we hopefully can lessen it. Right? Maybe you can't solve it, but maybe you can at least be the person that's not bigger when it leaves you. At least try. Not because of you. You know, if there's misunderstandings, be a clearinghouse for misunderstandings. What I'm saying is, when things come from me, come from you, may it be clear rather than more messed up. You know, he that soweth discord among brethren makes me think of someone who either deliberately or possibly for entertainment's sake enhances misunderstandings and disagreements. And we'd say none of us does this, surely. But let me ask you something. Or I should ask it to myself, actually. Do I take sides in a disagreement? Let's say there is, I don't know what it would be. Maybe it's in business, maybe it's in church, maybe it's in school, maybe it's in home. But somebody comes and gripes to me about something. Am I quick to side with that person and saying, oh, you poor thing? Or, yeah, that wasn't nice. I'm not saying that there's never a place for some compassion. That's not what I'm saying. But there's a big difference between saying, that would have been hard, but are you sure you understood it right? Don't quickly side. If you quickly side with people, and you know, I've seen this done both ways. I've seen people that were quick to side with authority, or people that are quick to side with what they felt was the underdog. You know, as a Christian, it's my job to bring about reconciliation, to have all people live in peace, not to choose sides. And if you're quick to side with anyone, I think you've got a problem with sowing discord. Shouldn't be a thing of picking sides. What about misunderstanding? Do I encourage a bitter person to consider the other point of view? Even if in your shoes, I would struggle with bitterness. But you know what? That's not all. There's more to this than what you're seeing. What do you leave with those that are either living with you or that pass you by in life? Matthew 5, verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children. If we were to put that in our language today, it would be the sons and daughters of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the son or daughter of God. Isn't that amazing? That you actually have an opportunity today, I do, to be God's son, to be his daughter. In the way I relate, don't choose sides. Don't sow discord. Where there's disagreements, may you be the one that finds agreement. Okay, so I'm going to paraphrase now. Proverbs 6, verse 16 through 19. These six things doth the Lord love. Yea, seven are a joy to him. A humble spirit. Lips of truth. A man who lays down his life for others. A heart seeking after God. Feet spreading the good news of the gospel. An honest witness that speaketh truth. And he that soweth peace among his brethren. Let's kneel for prayer.